Welcome to Educated Conjecture, an Ipsos podcast that combines what the public thinks with what the experts think. Each week, Ipsos's Mike College and Sean Simpson are joined by an informed guest to discuss a current or emerging issue. If a week is a long time in politics, consider that when Ipsos was founded in 1975, NASA launched the first joint U.S. and Soviet Union spaceflight. Betamax and VHS videotapes were introduced, and the Ethernet was just being born. In this episode, Simon Atkinson, Chief Knowledge Officer at Ipsos, joins Mike and Sean to talk about how Ipsos manages its wide range of knowledge and how common, and not so common, beliefs, attitudes, opinions, and issue concerns have been changing pre- and post-pandemic. And now, on to the episode.
Welcome to Educated Conjecture. It's Mike College here with my friend Sean Simpson. How are you today, Sean?
I'm well, Mike.
We've been a few weeks since we recorded a podcast. You were away. You were in the UK, yeah, then you were camping.
Yeah, getting murdered by black flies in Algonquin Park.
Yeah. And then I was away for a bit. So we're back, and it's middle of July in Canada, which means few people will listen to this because they're all at the cottage.
Hopefully.
Well, maybe they'll pick it up and listen to it at the cottage. Do you have a stat of the day or something you want to share with us?
I do. So Ipsos recently released research across 28 countries that asked people to reflect on how well their country does at taking in refugees. So this was meant to be before the Ukrainian conflict. And we have a little bit of a perception gap in Canada, which is very humbling, because we always like to think of ourselves in Canada as very welcoming, going above and beyond what may be required of our international peers and obligations. But in this case, we fall far short. So the results of this poll showed that nearly half, 46% of Canadians, believe that Canada falls in the top three refugee host nations in the world, in the top three. And in fact, 12% believe that Canada is the best. So it's humbling to find out the actual statistic, which is that we rank 34th in the world, well behind Turkey, Colombia, and the United States.
Which makes, at least in the case of Turkey, perfect sense if you think about geography.
Canada's
not easy to get to.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's a little bit of a flip on the quality of life data that we usually see, where around the world people say Canada's a great place. And in Canada we go, yeah, we're sort of middle of the pack.
Well, you know, and I have to chastise our political leaders are I think the ones that lead these sort of misperceptions that we do so well. Canadians buy into that narrative. It's a narrative that's been around for a long time here in Canada. So getting the reality check, I think, is both helpful but slightly disgraceful at the same time.
Yeah. Well, here's one where the political leaders are not leading the charge, and that's on financial health. So we do, as you know, we do a financial health index on a monthly basis. So just June over June, if you go back to June 21 versus June 22, there's been a decline. In June 21, it was -3%. That's the net of those who are doing well versus those who are doing poorly. Today, it's -16%, which means about 6 in 10 Canadians fall at the negative side. They're struggling, or they're sinking financially, and they're really having some struggles making ends meet. And about 4 in 10 or give or take, fall on the positive side. They're, you know, thriving, they're existing, they're doing okay. So we've seen a huge shift, despite, you know, a couple months ago, a lot of discussion on how the macroeconomic situation was great. Canadians have repeatedly told us that the macroeconomic situation doesn't really matter to me. What matters is the micro stuff. How's my household doing? And it's really taken a hold over the last year as we go into, potentially, as we discussed, another round of COVID in the country. So again, very, very interesting. And the other big interesting thing on that is that it has been the top of the K economy, those with greater incomes, who've started to droop a little bit and started to say, whoa, thought I was doing well, but with the slide in stocks and stuff, it's getting a little challenging. So I mentioned you were in the UK earlier, a couple weeks ago, Sean. We have a guest from the UK. You know how, Sean, I always say, you and I, we have great jobs. We get to see all of the data that comes in across Canada. We get to see this range of things. It feeds us on a regular basis. But we're going to have Simon Atkinson join us. And Simon is Chief Knowledge Officer, or also, I'm not sure which, head of the Ipsos Knowledge Center. We'll say Chief Knowledge Officer. And Simon gets to see data from around the world. So we he's got our job times, what, 30, Simon? Welcome.
Mm-hmm. Hello there. Hello. Hello, Mike. Hello, Sean. Great to be with you.
I did want to clarify something about Simon here before we continue, Mike, because it's very important. Simon was educated in Cambridge. Now, that's not Cambridge, Ontario, just to be clear. That's Cambridge, UK, which is why he's risen to the top of the Knowledge Center at Ipsos. I live in Waterloo region, right, which where Cambridge is. And yes, there's a difference.
OK.
Well, I'm talking to you today from London, but London, London, UK, rather than London, Ontario. You guys can advise me on how different the two cities are.
Also a big difference.
Well,
yeah.
There's a big difference. Well, welcome, Simon. You know, we will get to a discussion about what's happening in UK politics. I don't think we'll be able to avoid that just because of the recent resignations of top to bottom. I saw a great tweet that you'd sent out, or you had retweeted, some KFC trolling, was a bus stop in London, I'm assuming, that was are you a former cabinet minister? KFC is hiring, with the logo behind, which I thought was quite fantastic. So Simon, how about we start off, put you right on the spot, and talk about why Ipsos has a knowledge center. Maybe we'll start with a fairly broad discussion about why we do this.
Yeah, no, it is an interesting kind of starting point, because every organization, once it gets to a certain size, I think has a moment when it takes stock and has to think a little bit about what it's learned and what it knows during the period it's been in existence. And for Ipsos, this happened 6 or 7 years ago. It was celebrating its 40th birthday, and our founder Didier Truchot was undergoing a bit of a review about where we go next in the coming period, and a number of initiatives were launched, and one of them was the Knowledge Center. And in essence, he said, we've been going for 4 decades now, and we know a lot. We've got lots of scientists and researchers and great data, great information. But we haven't always written it down, and there's not a central place for us to go. And it means that we and our clients only see part of what we know. And that was really what set us to work, was to try and do some work. Let's say we operate in many countries, as you mentioned, Mike, some work to try to bring together some of the knowledge and data that Ipsos has accumulated over the years.
What's there? Is it thought leadership? Is it good examples of deliverables? Is it norms databases? What are all of these things that Ipsos has in the Knowledge Center, and to what purpose?
Well, no, the main emphasis actually has been around published material, published surveys, like the one you just mentioned, Sean, about the refugee survey, which took place in nearly 30 studies. So, and that was the track Ipsos went down, was it wanted to bring together what it had published and released. And I'm not a knowledge manager by trade, by background, but when I started to look into it, it was quite interesting seeing how other organizations had gone about it. Law firms are very good at documenting all of the past cases and very strong on the technology, enabling you to really go into the detail of what they've learned and bring that case law up quickly. Management consultancies seem to be very strong on kind of documenting all of their projects and the lessons they learned and all of those things that they advise the client on, so that if they get another brief, they've got all of that to hand. But our focus has been much more on bringing together material that we can share. And we were very influenced, I think, at the start by Wikipedia type approaches of kind of people creating, in essence, libraries or databases of content. And that was actually the first thing that we did, was to build an Ipsos encyclopedia of market research terms to try to write down some of these things that might be in people's heads.
It seems like having a knowledge center might be something that almost every major organization and company will eventually have. With the rise of social media, so many people are trying to push out knowledge as a way of attracting clients, as a way of sort of inserting themselves into discussions, whether they're lobbying governments or trying to sell business. Do you have any sort of thoughts for fledgling knowledge center managers, those who are just starting off, more generic, I guess, because as you mentioned, you know, the difference between law firms and consultancies, yeah, and us, but just in general?
Well, I think we did find it was helpful that we were given quite a clear brief to work on the encyclopedia first, actually. So I would say to focus on two or three areas would be one thing, rather than trying to do everything, because once you've got an organization that's, you know, even a few thousand people strong, and our company is bigger than that, there's quite a lot of complexity already baked in. And so I think that would be one of the things, would be to try to identify maybe two or three things to work on. Maybe one of them is a quick win that you can in some ways bring something quite quickly to the table, so people could see who you are and what it's all about. But then there might be one or two of the other projects. Perhaps they might involve some technology, or they might involve some further work to define exactly what the need is. Those might take longer. So without having too many priorities, but having one or two things that you can get runs on the board early on, I think is important to build that credibility, because these kind of knowledge initiatives tend to be internal brands, and actually, yeah, they're not always easy things to build in an established organization.
Yeah, I mean, it's most companies, insurance companies, everybody has something they're pushing out. I would think, and I don't know what you think, is it important that you be able to repurpose, right? Find things that you can use in more than one. I just look at today's very diffused media, right? Yeah. Some people get things from Reddit, others it's Instagram, others it's TikTok, other it's traditional TV news. I don't know, you know, somebody who has a newspaper delivered on a regular basis still happens, but, you know, those things have changed quite a bit. How do you, you know, find ways into all those different media?
Yeah, I think that has been one of the biggest changes when we started, and it's only 6 or 7 years ago. It was almost fine to let's say, if we were publishing a report, and we do some publications, to create a report and load it up onto the internet, and there you are. And now increasingly we're having to think about it probably may appear on a podcast in a discussion like the one that we're having now. It might appear in a short video. There might need to be some social media clips. You still need to have something that has got some depth, because I think people will spot quite quickly if it's just froth and you know, you haven't got any context, or it's not based on, let's say, some analysis or something new sometimes. But increasingly we are having to sort of operate in a more multimedia way, and the good thing about that is that you can keep things alive for longer, and actually these things, like you just mentioned, Sean, that the statistic you have on Canadians and refugees, that's actually quite an enduring statistic and an insight that you might use in a number of different contexts. So that's one of the kind of liberating things perhaps now, is that we're able to deploy more of the different toolkit of, you know, social media and multimedia techniques to let's say bring things to life for a longer period.
So what are your success criteria? How are you measuring that the Knowledge Center is having a positive impact on our business, on our clients, etc.?
Well, that's a good point. And I think one of the strongest measurements tends to be when you get that kind of more qualitative insight, that was really helpful, that you had, that we built that context into a particular report or program that we were doing with a client, because, you know, the Knowledge Center, what we're trying to do is provide some extra context, some extra understanding, some additional thing to bring to the story. So I would say often it's the qualitative stuff that comes back that was really helpful, or we used it in this presentation, or we were able to add some international dimension to something we were doing in a particular market. And I think, yes, there are some things that go very well on social media. And one of them has been something we do called What Where Is the World, which is increasingly becoming a bit of a reference point. So those ones, you can start to count your clicks and count the impact. But I think just as much, it's actually some of those things where people come back and say that really worked, and that helped us do more than we would otherwise been able to do for that client or with that particular objective.
And are you driving the content centrally? Like, is there some master plan that you've put into place, or is it more organic and you're sort of adopting things that you're finding around the world?
Well, there's a bit of both. One of the things in particular that we're increasingly doing now is planning planning releases around some of the key topics that are facing our clients and stakeholders and media all around the world. So I think we're increasingly looking ahead and thinking about, for example, one topic being sustainability, which I know you've covered on a previous podcast, but actually starting to think through, well, what are we going to be releasing and when on this topic. So there are some, you know, big themes that are affecting perhaps all of our clients in all of our countries that where we are starting to plan ahead. Another one is around the macro trends about demographic shifts and things like that. And I know you've discussed those previously on this before. And I think really we probably have a responsibility now to be bringing some new thinking on those topics. And we sat that alongside doing a little bit of work, literally in the rearview mirror, seeing what's been published, bringing it together, putting it into, if you like, our central library or database, but also publishing and republishing some of that for the clients as well. So there's a bit of looking forward and a bit of looking back, I think, is where we are.
I liked your comments about having some depth to what we do. And Sean and I, well, Sean leads the media, the piece in Canada, but we work on it together. And we're always focused on, rather than one question that is fleeting, how do we put some more depth around it? And often, you know, when we get something that, well, not necessarily we're unsure, but we're always looking for a deeper meaning. So there's a discussion back and forth internally with us about what's it mean, where's it going, and what are the implications of this number or that number. But long before we get to posting the 47% or whatever the number is and writing it up, can you talk, because I've been involved internally on the global piece in Knowledge Center, but can you talk a little bit about what you do internally to bring it together? Because it's not just you going, I'm going to pull things together and write a publication. I know that there's a lot more breadth to it, and you've involved a lot of people in the organization.
Yeah, and there's different types of people in the organization. We've involved, you know, I guess, you know, the heart of Ipsos is that we're a research company, and we're all about, you know, collecting information and data to really sort of, let's say, bring something new to a particular problem and question. So some of the work we're doing is a little bit more technical, because we're creating, let's say, some new publications around a particular piece of analysis, maybe involving some of our behavioral scientists or some of the people who are working on specific areas like advertising research or thinking about brands. So I think we're working with some other real specialists who are subject matter experts of various kinds. And I think that's been really, really interesting, particularly when we're bringing them together and there are joint pieces, perhaps from people in different countries or different backgrounds. And then we're also working with other specialists, for example. We've got a couple of particular areas where we're really focusing on a more technical piece around the knowledge management, so that you can actually access the information and it's properly tagged and organized and thought through. And that's a discipline in itself. I mean, if we ever go to a library, even if it's our small town library or a big university library or whatever, there's of course a methodology underpinning it all that means we hopefully can find things. And quite interesting history, of course, which goes back to before the amazing computers we have now, but we have been drawing on some of that, both in terms of the technique, but also in terms of what a library is about, which increasingly these days is perhaps having some shelves with books, metaphorically speaking, but also having some areas you can go and browse, and maybe there's a place you can go and have a coffee and talk to some staff. So metaphorically speaking, I think we're trying to bring elements of a great library to our teams around the world, even though they may be experiencing it a bit more virtually.
Like universities, do you have is everything go through a peer review or just some of it, or it depends on the weight?
Focus. Yeah, it does depend a bit on the way. I think that's a very good point. I think everything's gone through a peer review to a degree, in that the surveys that we release have always gone through some kind of checking processes and validation in that sense. But we have built some additional processes around the points of view that we publish. So those do go through a peer review process where different people take a look at it and they do it, they feedback anonymously. So we've had to build a kind of process there. And in particular, the encyclopedia that we built, for that to have credibility, it needs to have a particular kind of process. So if you're going there, you're trying to find, what does Ipsos know on this topic? What's its definition? And even if I'm very knowledgeable about something, it's not really good enough that that's the definition. It needs to be reviewed and added to and sometimes criticized by other colleagues before we put it live.
Okay.
How difficult was it in such a large organization, global organization like Canada, like Ipsos is rather, to set up a knowledge center? Was it easier than you thought, harder than you thought? Where were the roadblocks?
I think one of the things that helped us has been the advances, quite frankly, in speaking and literacy in English in the last 10 or 15 years. It's really noticeable how English has become the mother language, the mother tongue of international organizations. But even if you went back to 2005, 2010, you would have noticed some differences. Now, that's not to say that we never translate things or that everything had been in English. So I'm not saying that, but it does at least give us one kind of language where the core content is available. So I think that's helped us. I think the biggest roadblock is in essence, what we're trying to do is to give access to a much broader and deeper range of information. And I think that the biggest roadblock, I think, is always making sure that people know and think about what's available at that time when they need it. So, I wonder if Canada's different from the other countries around the world. How do we differ from the US? How does that change over time? Maybe there's some other countries who are reference points that we should look into. Those kinds of questions, clearly are in a textbook of what a good researcher should do. But, if you're on a deadline, you need to be able to get the information quickly and you need to know it's available and where to get it from. So I think that's still perhaps the ongoing biggest challenge for us is almost making this content, this material so famous and so easy to access that people will go and look for it.
You were talking about, differences that you see, because a lot of the work we do is obviously in 28, 30 countries around the world. What are some of those macro, high level differences that you see? Either you can say between North Americans and Europeans, for example, or UK, Canada, US, I think would be of the most interest to our listeners.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things I was quite surprised by, given we've just been still going through the global pandemic. You mentioned, Mike, the cases are rising in your country and indeed mine. But one of the things we were surprised by, I think, with this pandemic was still how different the countries were. Even to take the example of Europe, neighboring countries, which in principle have similar forms of government, maybe a similar religion, maybe experiencing COVID to a greater or lesser extent in similar numbers. But still, we found such big differences in the kind of the lived experience that people were having or the ratings of their government. And I mean, maybe it sounds a bit obvious to say countries matter, but it really struck home to me that you need to be careful about talking about global figures. And even in our own work, we're increasingly careful about talking about, look, this is just the global country average. That's all it is. And we have to be really careful, I think, about the labeling and how we describe things. So I think that's one of the big things I've noticed, even within the last 2 or 3 years going through that pandemic.
That's and you've got, like you mentioned, the pandemic, but you've been through Brexit, the pandemic, economic ups and downs since you started this job. Is there a most defining thing you've noticed in terms of, the shift in public views that has changed the course or is changing the course? I mean, you mentioned the pandemic was universal in how it applied to people, maybe, and nobody was left unscathed, but very different how we responded.
I think one of the questions that we're thinking about the pandemic is we're almost having to kind of, it's a bit of an overused phrase now, but pivot to a degree, and because we're almost trying to now to compare now with before the pandemic, and it's quite difficult now to actually, if you wanted to come up some simple narratives, you sometimes have to pause. I mean, you were talking about the figures on refugees earlier, Sean, and I think actually an earlier release of that study was looking at how people feel about forcibly displaced people around the world. And on one level, you can say, because of Ukraine, people are now seem to be much more positive than about countries giving, you know, giving access and welcome to displaced people than they were. But actually, it's much more complicated than that. Of course, there's lots of other crises around the world, not just Ukraine. Even when we look back to 2019, it's actually been seems to be changing, and people seem to be, in principle, more open. So I think that's one of the things we're unpicking now is comparing now with before the pandemic. And it's really an interesting sort of question. And one of the things that, as we started to look at some of this now, one of the things that's a reminder is concerns around poverty, crime, unemployment were always with us, and there was, yeah, you know, and are still there. So there's almost like a kind of join with where we are now and where we were just a few years ago.
Yeah, I think we see that in Canada with clients who, as we inflation rises, cost of living, affordability becomes a concern, worries around a recession, we started to have clients say, well, can we go back and look at 2008, 2010 and where we were? Can we go back a little further? And the answer is usually not really, because in those places we didn't come out of 2.5 years of a pandemic where we were in a lot of trouble. And, you know, so that resiliency, I know you and I worked on I'd love you to talk a little bit about the lessons learned from the pandemic and the adaptability. And we did prove really adaptable, but it feels like in Canada anyway, we have adapted all we can, and now we're a little bit tapped out. So if the next recession, you know, they're saying it's going to be fairly moderate, but if it is deep, it may lead to a lot more change than we think.
Yeah. No, the Brexit one is an interesting one. It's 6 years almost to the day as we're talking now in the summer, and still working itself through both what its implications are for what you might call the high politics and in Westminster in our case, but also what the enduring impact of not just Brexit, but what it means for the economy and what it means for society and people's aspirations. And I think perhaps it serves as a reminder of just sometimes these things, you have to be very careful. We've been very careful about not concluding anything and just just kind of opting out. But equally, some of these things do change only gradually, and it's quite an art, I think, unpicking them.
So speaking of Brexit and the UK,
yes,
and resignations, yes. Did I mention resignations? what is happening in your country, my friend?
Well, we are about to have our fourth prime minister in the last 6 years.
We almost think we're in Italy.
Yes, indeed. And we know that Boris Johnson is
sorry, Chiara.
Yeah, exactly. that Boris Johnson, let's say, is arguably the architect of the downfall of the last three, including himself. So he has been a player in each of that. I think it has been an interesting thing to watch, because there's lots of things interconnected there, including, by the way, the COVID pandemic and how that was handled and residual questions there, because we did have, I would say, that was the first point about a few weeks into the COVID crisis. There were questions around the truth and who was telling the truth and was the truth coming out of 10 Downing Street. But that was more than 2 years ago now. What we've seen, I think, by any means, people say a week is a long time in politics. We're talking in July. The week leading up to his resignation was quite unbelievable. It felt a bit like it was happening at Westminster rather than out on the streets or with the, you know, in terms of public demonstrations. I mean, with the fall of Margaret Thatcher going back 30 years, there were public demonstrations were clearly influential. The Tony Blair's, defining moment in some ways was the war in Iraq, and there were huge public demonstrations there. I would say the opinion polling is pretty clear. The public are not and were not happy with Boris Johnson, and he did fall from grace quite quickly in terms of the opinion polls. But it has really been a kind of, capital city seat of government show with their own MPs kind of imploding in terms of how they feel, and as you say, many of them actually resigning.
Do you think that's in part a summertime issue? We're busy. There's other things going on. We're post-pandemic. We need some joy in our lives, so we're not going to go protest what's going on. But maybe if that had been the fall, you might have seen more protests.
I don't know, because I think it's been more of a drip, drip, drip one, this one. Okay. That there has been a gradual erosion, I would say, in trust. And I remember one of the influential journalists talking about this in his article in the Times. It's kind of, it doesn't matter until it matters. And he, you know, yeah. Boris Johnson was famously had nine lives, or did he have 99 lives? He was famously described by David Cameron, of course, who went to university with him, one of our former prime ministers, as a greased piglet who always escaped. And, you know, of course, many of the articles were saying we actually weren't expecting this. I would say even a couple of weeks ago,
right.
I think people were feeling maybe it's 50-50 that he will get through this and survive to the next election. But suddenly it mattered. And there was a particular moment when one of the leading civil servants, they don't normally speak in public, this person had retired, wrote a letter saying, no, the prime minister is not telling the truth. He was briefed about this particular topic. I was there, and this is how it was. And in a way, I'm not saying it was the smallest scandal, but it wasn't necessarily the biggest one that they've experienced.
It was the tipping point.
Suddenly mattered. Yeah, it really was.
It was the tipping point.
Sort of a third party credible source that's not affiliated with a party came in and said this is what we saw. Yeah. So did Boris Johnson fundamentally change over the last, you know, 2-3 years? And Brits are reacting to the way that he's changed, or has he been the same guy all along, but what they liked about him a few years ago, they start to despise about him a few years hence?
Well, I don't know him personally, but I think the view is he hasn't changed. He's been the same guy all along. I think he's clearly very charismatic, and I think in particular, a great campaigner. Mm. I mean, both for Brexit and in the election that he won so well in 2019, able to communicate, as they say, in ways that other politicians can't, and to reach people that other politicians can't. But I think also some people who, let's say, have known him for long periods of time were questioning what he would be like in government as a manager, as an administrator. And I think let's just say at the moment they're saying that, well, this is what we were expecting. So that difference between campaigner and governor, we might reflect on for some other politicians in some other countries around the world.
Well, many, many politicians, right? And mm-hmm. I think the pressures of modern day media make the strong campaigner a prerequisite during elections, because you have to touch on an awful lot of things. It moves fast. And strong campaigners don't always, as you know, to just make the best governors, the best managers of the public service, and finding that balance is always, it seems to be, you know, it has been more tricky in the last decade.
Maybe it would have been fine for Boris Johnson, but, you know, Brexit is complicated, unprecedented. COVID was complicated and unprecedented. Mm-hmm. And inflation may not be unprecedented, but, you know, certainly coming off the back of those two things, I think that they are really, really tricky problems now.
It is unprecedented for people under 40.
Absolutely.
Right? There's a lot of people who've never experienced or had to live through it. So for them, you know, it is if it hasn't hit them yet, it's about to become quite a big shock.
Sure. Yeah.
I guess, you know, he sort of came in as a not anti-establishment, but he doesn't look or sound like, you know, the way that your typical British prime minister looks or sounds. You know, he's obviously got allies, or else he wouldn't have gotten where he got. But he's also got a lot of enemies, and it almost seems to me that it's inevitable in British politics that at some point the knives are going to come out if you didn't come up playing the same rules as everybody else.
Yes. Well, no, exactly. Well, people have been trying to calculate when the last prime minister left office as a result of a general election.
Mm-hmm.
Defeat, and we're going back to 1974.
Yeah,
because it's basically, you know, it genuinely, certainly here, you know, your career as prime minister ends in failure and seems to be ended by your own party who wants to get rid of you, and that applies to Labour as well as the Conservatives.
Not very representative, is it?
No.
Hey, don't. That's wild. What's the most? Okay, how long have you had your current position? 8 years now?
Yeah, 7 or 8 years. Yeah.
What's the coolest thing you've learned in terms of? Well, most interesting. You see everything. Yeah. You see the nation brand indexes. You see what worries the world. You've seen our forecast work. You've seen our marketing work that we do. Perils of perceptions. So if you had to pick one, it doesn't have to be a data point, but just one that you were like, you know what, that one really stuck and made me change my views.
Well, I think actually coming back to the pandemic, I think one of the coolest things I've seen actually is asking people to self-assess where they are right now. And I thought that was really neat. It was first developed by one of our qualitative teams who those are listeners who may not be familiar with market research, but they're not known necessarily for doing questionnaires and numbers, but they actually defined a scale from there's no pandemic here, everything is fine, through to I'm having to adjust to new restrictions, through to it's the new normal and the pandemic is over. There are about 7 different categories. And that question, I really liked it. It was we were asking people for their self-assessment right here, right now, where they were sitting. And the reason I say it's the coolest, because it's a reminder that to all of us that things don't move in a linear direction, because so many times individual countries, let's say, were going forwards and then they went backwards. It was just quite an underline, the sort of the dynamic, because sometimes if we just we're in a business sometimes of quoting data and statistics and it all seems very rational, but I think that kind of just underlined to me the unpredictability of it all and how our work is never done, just in terms of trying to even take the temperature. That's even before you start to try and predict the future and work out what's going to happen next. So maybe that's the coolest.
Great.
And what's the one piece of critical data that we release on a ongoing basis that you think that both Ipsos researchers internally, but also our clients should pay attention to?
I think the what worries the world for any client is particularly relevant, because in our different countries, there are many different local or national indicators on how people are doing. And, you've got some amazing data in Canada, of course, going back for decades. But the what worries the world, where we're asking people in 28 countries to pick out the 3 issues that most affect their country every month, I think is been a really good reference point. The big story, of course, is the rise of concerns about cost of living. But a bit like the frog being boiled, that's sometimes used in management textbooks and things, it didn't happen overnight. It was just month by month. It went up 3%, 4%, 5%. And there's always a story or an angle or something to think about in there, including where our country is different or similar to other countries.
I think we first saw it in Canada in October of last year.
Yeah,
it was like a 3-point bump or a 4-point jump in the monthly tracking. And we were like, and our chief research officer, Chris Martin, said, given where we're at post pandemic, if this continues, it'll be a real struggle, because there's just not the slack isn't there in the economy for people at the household level. And it just kept, as you said, 3 points, 2 points, 4 points, 3 points, 4 points. And all of a sudden, it's the biggest issue.
Yeah,
so absolutely. I have a personal question, Simon.
Yes.
For those of you who don't or haven't followed Simon on Twitter, you tweet some of the best pictures that range from ski hills and Les Arcs, where you have a blog, through to some of the just amazing pictures, like you're all over the UK on a regular basis. Do you have a background in architecture, and is that what pulls you to that?
No, I don't have a background in architecture. I have got interested in it. You mentioned the ski hill example, and the resort I go to is a resort in France, which has very interesting history, both architecturally and socially, because in essence, in the 60s and 70s, there was a big initiative to develop skiing for the masses, and basically huge apartment blocks were built on the sides of the mountains. Not everybody loves the architecture, but in a way it was... If you put all the concrete to one side, it was relatively green in terms of it doesn't have a huge footprint. And there was a whole kind of literature of architecture about bringing people's more holidays for more people. So that's kind of got me into that. Traveling around the UK, I think I've just enjoyed the wonders of an iPhone, just being able to sort of spot on the crop things and post them up. So, but I am very interested in, I guess we've got an older building stock than perhaps at least some parts of Canada. I'm always interested in what we're knocking down. Because you know, there's a question sometimes about some of the 19th century buildings that we've got, we and indeed the 20th century buildings now, we're starting to knock those down, and that I think is a very interesting debate, because then you get into questions about history and indeed the environment, about is this a green thing to do to knock it down, because maybe it wasn't very environmentally friendly in terms of how it's operating, but we know that building a new construction may not be particularly good for the environment either. So I'm quite interested in that debate, because and I think it's one of those things that falls between the cracks of government, local and national government. Nobody's really in charge of this. So, you know, one thing is being protected while something else a few miles away maybe being knocked down. And there seems to be no rhyme or reason. So it's, as a researcher, I try to put my nose into it and see what's going on.
It's actually, I love the shots, and I love my my early morning briefs on how Barnett's doing.
yes.
It's often played by play after the first half.
Yes, this I'm not sure your listeners will want to get into it, but this is a soccer team at the fifth level of English soccer. So they're just about professional in terms of their money. But if you watch them play, you might question how professional they really are. But it's never boring.
That's okay. The same thing happens with the Toronto Blue Jays baseball team, Simon.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. Sean, do you have any other questions for Simon?
No, it's been great. I've got a lot of reading to do, I think, on the Knowledge Center.
Very good.
Well, thank you very much, Simon.
Well, thank you very much. It's great too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts for another episode of Public Opinion and Informed Insights. If you have a topic you'd like to see covered on an upcoming episode, please send us an email at publicaffairs@ipsos.com. That's publicaffairs@ipsos.com.